Thank you very much, and welcome to another bout of competitive wordplay between four of the nicest word players that I know, Dilys Powell and Frank Muir. Versus Antonia Fraser and Dennis Norden. And we start, as always, by plunging recklessly into the dictionary in search of meaning. Frank, what's the meaning of fustigation? F-U-S-T-I-G-A-T-I-O-N.
Well, fustian is a cheap, dark cloth, or it's a bombastic speech. So it's castigation. It's shouting a person down with loud and pompous language.
It's a very good invention, that. We'll give you one and a half. One and a half for that. Now, the meaning
You're
is...
You're not suggesting that I'm incorrect, are
you? I am hinting that you're incorrect. It is the act of whacking with a cudgel, fustigation. Antonia, what is a wraith? W-R-A-I-T-H, a wraith.
A wraith is a form of ghost, isn't it?
What form of ghost?
Is it the sort that knocks about graveyards?
It's its timing that tends to make it a wraith rather than an ordinary routine spectre or inspector.
Well, that gives me a few the hours of darkness to juggle with. Does it turn up at dawn?
I mean, most ghosts are ghosts of dead people.
Oh, you mean it's...
But a wraith can...
Be a ghost of a sort of an evanescence of a living person.
Well done, that's one mark. That's well, a brilliant, intuitive move.
I want to tell you that there's something very strange and spectral just behind you.
I'll take 0.5 of a mark away for that. Try to terrify me. It can be both. It's a person's double or apparition seen shortly before or after their death. Dilys, what's the meaning of hubristic? H-U-B-R-I-S-T-I-C.
I think it really means rather above yourself. It comes from the Greek, who were rather given to hubris, which was rather daring to challenge fate and the will of the gods. And if you were hubristic... If you were guilty of hubris, anything might happen to you. All your children might be struck dead, or you might have no head. Anything might happen to you if you had hubris and you were hubristic.
I think you get 3 marks for that. Dennis, a graphospasm. G-R-A-P-H-O-S-P-A-S-M.
It's another rotten medical word, is it not?
Well, I didn't know it was until I looked it up today.
Maybe you were away when they did graphospasm.
More than likely.
Grapho. It's a drawing of a hiccup in a medical textbook.
2 marks for Dennis.
Is it a drawing of a hiccup?
And the real meaning is writer's cramp, which is much more mundane. Actually, you could have got a bonus mark if you'd called it Scrivener's palsy, which I'm sure is what people on this programme get. We move on to announcing the quotations that Frank and Dennis have been given for the last round. And Frank's is, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And it's the opening of A Tale of Two Cities. And Dennis's is Alice Through the Looking Glass, a book by Carol Levis. Now, meanwhile, we'll be coming to those later on. Meanwhile, a round entitled Four of a Kind. What do the following quartet of words have in common? And Frank sound rather like West Country firm of solicitors. Quiblin, Whiblin, Quillet and Carrywitchet.
Quiblin.
Quiblin.
Yeah.
Stop your quibblin', jock. Yeah. Whiblin.
Never mind the joke, because I just had the word.
Just giving you time to write in case you've got a touch of the cramp. Quillet.
Quillet.
And Carrywitchet.
A Carrywitchet I've met as a play on words. Mm. Quiblin I've never met, but a quibble was used frequently throughout the 18th century and presumably earlier as a play on words, in fact a pun.
You're there. 2 marks, to Frank. Yeah. They're all ancient synonyms for a pun. Antonia, what do these four words have in common? To kirkle, to yaffle, to gobble, and to boom.
Once bitten, twice shy.
Yes, yes, that's your booming.
Yes.
I can't get it.
What? No, what sort of thing gobbles?
Turkey.
Yes, and what, therefore, what sort of thing... Yeah. What sort of thing yaffles?
Woody,
there's a little woody fellow.
A pecker of that name.
Woodpecker, yaffles.
Yes.
Kirkle, a very small noise it must be.
Kirkle.
Kirkle. I've never heard them, only eaten them.
Quail?
Yes.
Oh.
Well done. Mm-hmm. 2 marks. All are cries of birds, the quail, the woodpecker, the bittern, and the turkey.
Do quails kirkle?
Yes.
I wonder if kirkle's quail.
Dillis, what do these four words have in common? Brunch, motel, chortle, and smog.
Chortle and what? Smog.
Smog, S-M-O-G. Brunch, motel...
The first one is brunch.
Mm.
Brunch is breakfast and lunch in one. It's two things in one.
Motel?
Motel is a motor in a hotel, is it?
Yes, indeed.
Is it?
We're nearly there, aren't we?
Oh, well.
Chortle
is chuckle and... I don't know, it's anyhow two words together.
Yes, it is two words together.
They're all two words together, aren't they?
That gets you the mark. Well done. Chortle is alleged to be a hybrid of chuckle and snort, but I think it's an original sound of its own, chortle. Dennis, what do these four words have in common? Stableford, Culbertson, Bertillon... and Ashwell.
They're all proper names.
Yes.
Right. Next round. Bertillon, something to do with fingerprints.
That's right, yes. Culbertson?
Culbertson did something... Eli Culbertson, one of the few famous people called Eli, did something with bridge. It's a system of playing bridge.
And that gets you your 2 marks, because it's the system. It's the Bertillon system. Stableford system?
I don't know. I never heard of a Stableford system, no. Never heard of an Ashwell system.
Yeah, well, the Ashwell I'll tell you about.
That's medical. The Ashwell is a medical system.
The Ashwell is rather exciting. But Stableford is golfing. It's a way of scoring in golf when you have a golf competition. But the Ashwell system, and this is the one I think the great discovery of our word setter Peter Moore, is a system of a ratchet and bolt operating on an engaged vacant window to show whether a lavatory is occupied or, as it says here, otherwise. Anyway, 2 marks to Dennis for. Discovering they were all...
Came to me like a bolt from the loo.
Now a round of newspaper headlines, and I'm going to give you some incidents each, and we'd like to know how tabloid newspapers, if they'd been printed at the time, would have headlined these incidents. I'll give you each one to start with, and you can think about it, and then we'll come back to Frank for his. And Frank is, Sir Walter Raleigh spreads his cloak to spare Queen Elizabeth getting muddy feet. We want a tabloid headline for that. Antonia, an apple falling on Sir Isaac Newton's head prompts his discovery of gravitation. Dillis, King Canute fails to halt the incoming tide. And Dennis, the young George Washington admits to cutting down the cherry tree. So now what we want are newspaper headlines. If tabloid newspapers had been printed at the time, can you suggest the headline for the following historical happenings? And Frank, Sir Walter Raleigh spreads his cloak to spare Queen Elizabeth getting muddy feet.
Bright night keeps Queen clean in puddle muddle.
Very nice. And Antonia, an apple falling on Sir Isaac Newton's head prompts his discovery of gravitation.
Mad scientist in fruit drama.
Dillis, King Canute fails to halt the incoming tide.
Surging seas slap royal kisser.
Dennis, the young George Washington admits to cutting down the cherry tree.
Axe-carrying youth spurns lie detector.
Yes, well, you all did so well on that. We're going to give you 100 marks each for that. So now we move on to a round of double-barreled words, words like willy-nilly and hurly-burly. Almost repetitive, but not quite. Now, what such word can be defined in this way, Frank? Reckless or wild in conduct. We want a double-barreled word.
Hurly-burly.
Not quite.
Not quite.
Nearly.
That was in the clues, yeah.
Was it?
But you, I thought you were going to start. If you could, you were starting.
Was that good?
That's good. And if you, it rhymes with a rotten borough that used to be on Salisbury Plain.
Oh, old. Old so.
Yeah. So.
Heum scoem.
Well done, 2 marks.
Why am I being demoted? I got 100 last round.
Antonia, a double-barrel word that means in disorderly haste.
Hugger-mugger.
Think of something that you might have seen in a fun fair and you'll get in disorderly haste.
Oh, that, yes, that thing that goes...
She's doing the action now, everybody,
yes.
At home. The finger is going round in circles and moving up and down.
Hurly-burly. What is it?
It's not a welter.
No.
It's
helter-skelter.
2 marks, Antonia.
2 marks for the audience.
And a bonus mark to the lady in the second row. Dillis, weak or ineffectual?
Namby-pamby.
No. Good guess.
That's
good. I don't think ineffectual, weak, but not ineffectual.
Itsy bitsy.
Think of a Chinese laundryman. We'll get
to that.
I can't think of anything else.
Starchy watchy. Oh, wishy washy.
Wishy washy.
Say it louder, Dillis.
Wishy washy.
2 marks. And a bonus mark to the person in the third row. Dennis, feelings of depressive discomfort.
H.J.
The second part of it describes phonetically
Jeepers
the creepers. Letters you put on the back of your car when you travel abroad.
G.B. Very good. Heebie-jeebies.
How did you get it too much? So now we come to the last round.
Stand there.
G.B. You put G.B. on the back of your car, so heebie-jeebies.
Oh.
Yeah.
We've come to the last round, so we hope, Frank, you understand the quotation that you're going to tell us about, which is, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
Now, you probably reckon that everybody read newspapers just after the Civil War, say in about 1673. But no. Newspapers started up, though. Two newspapers started up in rural England, one in Oxfordshire, one pioneer newspaper in Oxfordshire, and one pioneer newspaper in Worcestershire, as it's then called. And the one in Oxfordshire was started up in Bicester. And it was started up by a retired pig farmer called Robert Muxwell. Robert Muxwell started up a newspaper called the Bicester Times and Dairy Farmers Almanac. But he had a bitter rival in Worcester. A newspaper was started up by a rich Australian ex-poultry farmer called Rupert Mudduck. And these rich men really were tremendous business rivals. Now, the trouble is with newspapers, they had no type in those days, so they were handwritten. And suddenly, Rupert invented a technological breakthrough known as the jelly graph. He found that if you get a tray of jelly and write with purple ink on it, you can put the paper, roll it down hard against the jelly, peel it off, and ink still stays on the paper. And you can do this about 40 times. So you've got 40 jellies. So he sold these printed jellies. And for a while was very successful. So immediately, Robert used this jelly process. With the jelly process, they were both printing 40 each and selling them. The circulation was the same. It was then they decided, Robert decided on competition, and he started up what he called Stingo. And the readers had to fill in little numbers. And if they won, they got a pint of Stingo, which was very strong beer. And then Rupert, in order to cap this, enlarged the prize. So they used to drink beer out of leather tankards called jacks in those days. And he made an enormous great vessel which held 40 gallons of Stingo, which he called the jackpot. And for a while he was ahead. But then Robert got a jackpot, you see. And their circulations rose by then to 173 each. But they were still level. And then Rupert brooded. And then he came up with an idea. Quibbles were very popular in those days. Everybody loved quibbles. And Rupert, there were dozens and dozens of books of them. So Rupert gathered all these books, made an enormous collection, and advertised that his top prize was going to be £1 million. The first time £1 million had ever been offered as a prize in a newspaper. So immediately Robert knew about this. So he too offered £1 million. Well, their circulation rose to about 2,000 copies each. And God knows what would have happened, except the whole thing was sabotaged by a group of people, lads, who were terribly worried about this mechanization of printing with jelly grass. And they decided on violence, and they crept in one night and just emptied all the jelly out and replaced it with clarified lard. And the chaps who did all this damage were known as Lardites. Now, that's how all this newspaper competition started. So when people say to you now, oh, of course, these modern papers with these huge cash prizes, this is a new thing in journalism, you say, no, these new papers weren't the ones who started it. I'll tell you who were responsible for this. And you know, don't you, which papers really started all this. I have to use the modern pronunciation of the towns, but the papers responsible for this, well, it was the Bicester Times and it was the Worcester Times.
Thank you for that moving account of the origin of edible news. Let's see how you get on, Dennis, with Alice Through the Looking Glass.
And what a bittersweet memory that line evokes, because it's almost exactly what I wrote in my schoolboy diary to describe one of the most powerful and formative experiences of my entire childhood. Not that my childhood wasn't crammed with powerful and formative experiences. There was a time that Knocker Harris, the school bully, knocked me to the ground, sat on my chest, and licked all the red off my gobstopper. there was a junior school experience, which probably led to my lifelong fear of heights, the time I played seesaw with Fatty Birkinshaw, and he kept me marooned for 40 minutes in the up position. and that's not to mention the event that must have been as searing to the young mind as any, that memorable prize-giving day when, suffering some kind of mental aberration, Wally Abingdon got up on the platform and bared his bottom to the whole school. Our boy doesn't forget a thing like that. Especially as he was the headmaster. but influential as those happenings may have been in shaping my future character, none of them so deserves the description seminal as one sudden giddy moment during a biology class when I was about 13. Now, everybody was encouraged to do biology in those days because it was widely believed that when you left school there was no knowing when an employer might not suddenly ask you to dissect a frog. But truth to tell, it was a subject that I enjoyed about as much as the frog did. So as it was one of those hot and rather drowsy mornings, summer mornings that we seem to have so many of back then, I was off in one of my daydreams. Can't remember now which daydream it was. It was probably the usual one about having both the power of invisibility and the key to the Dagenham Girl Piper's dressing room. but whatever direction my thoughts were tending, they were abruptly wrenched back to reality, because I suddenly realized that across the crowded classroom, a girl called Alice Tozer was staring at me with a message in her gaze that could only be described as naked, unashamed yearning. Now, for you to appreciate the full effect that such a glance would have had on my boy's sensibilities, to understand just what a turn-up for the book it portended, you must have some idea of the place that Alice Tozer occupied in Form 4B folklore. Now, not only did she have a physical configuration which had matured to the extent where she could clean the chalk off the blackboard with both hands behind her back, but her tolerant attitudes towards certain matters had made her the only girl in the middle school with four exclamation marks next to her name on the wall of the boys' loo. So the fact that I was the one to whom she was, as it were, making an obscene telephone call with her eyes, me, who'd never expected to encounter any kind of encouraging glance from a girl, well, while it might be exaggerating to claim that that was the point at which I crossed the frontier from boyhood to manhood, just the same, it was a profound enough moment for me to record it that night in my schoolboy diary, not only in red ink, but ringed round with magenta starbursts. Of course, being me, I never actually went as far as what you might call cashing in on Alice's promissory note, partly, I suppose, because of that melancholy inability to recognize a sure thing that has always characterized your true wimp, but also, it should be said, because of something that only occurred to me while I was still thrashing about restlessly at 2 a.m. that night. And that was that where I'd been sitting when I became conscious of Alice's ravening gaze was directly in front of the windowsill on which she'd placed the satchel containing her lunchtime sandwiches. Now, to this day, I don't know which of us her thoughts were actually dwelling on, but something within me still treasures the interpretation that I confided to my diary that evening. Alice, fruity look in class.
Thank you, Dennis, for yet another exploration of the happiest days of your life. Well, we've run all the answers through our new all-electric MyWord computer, and this tells us that this week's winners are Dillis and Frank. So after the show, they'll have to buy the first round at the BBC's soft drink dispenser. And until we all meet again, goodbye.